Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the morning after. I am in Aspen, so I had the Rocky Mountain High experience of watching, altitude-wise, of watching the debate. And Rick Wilson is in our Washington, D.C. studio. How are you, Rick?
Charlie, I am prospering. Thank you.
Okay, so we're gonna title this podcast "Two Angry Old White Guys Yelling at Clouds" because I think we might have a take. I was actually on Stephanie Ruhle's show on MSNBC this morning, and I knew this was going to happen. Where I said, "Listen, I think that was a bad debate for Democrats if you actually want to beat Donald Trump, because you had this massive move to the left. You had Elizabeth Warren doubling down on taking away people's private health insurance." And of course, Twitter exploded with the usual sort of thing. Let's say, here's one. Charlie Sykes on Stephanie Ruhle is clearly a Trump bag guy, advising Dems not to go after their base. Deceitful, not even cunning. This is the nice stuff.
Wait, you're a Trump bag guy? That must make me like a Trump golf caddy.
well, yesterday I was accused of being a Trump filleter in anything. So, you know, here's another one. Who cares what Charlie Sykes thinks about the Democratic Party? Here's somebody else. I don't know about you, but when I wake up after the first Democratic debate, the first person I need to hear from is Charlie Sykes, with a gif of somebody muting. And there's some stuff that uses some colorful language, which we will probably use all of this. And of course, the, you know, MSNBC neocons have no place in this discussion. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank Christ MSNBC has Charlie Sykes on to analyze the debate, because I care deeply about what conservative douche-shits think Democrats should do. Okay, so we're going to... We'll devote this entire podcast to conservative douche-shits, talking about what happened last night as we yell at the clouds. My take was, and I really didn't want to say this, that was a really good night for Donald Trump. And if people know where Rick and I come down on this, that is painful. Not only did they not hammer Trump, they barely mentioned him. And it was like, how weird can we be? You know, lots more free stuff. Yes, we are going to take away your private health insurance, licensing, registration of guns. You know, let's not be so mean to the Taliban. It's like abortion for all, including trans people. So, Rick Wilson, your take on this?
On the one hand, Charlie, I have a small, like, little window of hope, because this is an early debate. And in the early debates in every election cycle I've been through, and it's a lot of them now since 88, the early debates don't end up being as decisive as you think they'll be at the moment. However, we live in the era where the internet is forever, and where memory is permanent in every single clip and every single debate statement and every single, you know, moment. So the one person on that stage who has a meaningful chance of getting to the big show, Elizabeth Warren, came out last night and said that she's down with taking away people's private health insurance. Now, look, I get the motivation for that. She's in a death struggle with Bernie Sanders right now. And she wants to get the Bernie bro base, and they don't want to have private health insurance in this country. But since I live in a world where empirical data and polling and actual voter behavior matters, people want their private health insurance. In fact, Obamacare was sold on the fact they were going to keep their private health insurance. You know, keeping your doctor is not code for keeping your doctor. It's code for keeping the insurance policy that allows you to see your doctor. So the elimination, the substitution for of saying we're going to get rid of private health insurance plans, health insurance companies may be son of a bitches. People may hate them with a fire of a million suns, but they do not want it replaced by the post office or the DMV. And I guarantee you, there are a lot of smart guys on the Trump's campaign, not Trumpers, the guys who are the consultant class, all the guys like me, who used to do this for, you know, I used to do this for a living, and all these guys that still do, underneath the radar screen, they're going to ignore the Donald Trump bloviating and screaming and tweeting, and they're going to be communicating with swing voters over and over again. Elizabeth Warren wants to take your health insurance away. She wants to force you on the government plan, like the VA that failed your children, or your son who went to war, or failed your husband who went to war. And the easy lift.
Oh, it is an easy lift. And the point I tried to make was, look, they could spend a half billion dollars making this case. Now, the polls that I've seen and the within the blue bubble, they're citing these polls showing that Medicare for all is very, very popular, which it is if you describe it as Medicare for all. And one of the reasons why it's very popular is no one knows what Medicare for all actually means.
Right.
When they are told, you know, would you be in favor of this if you learned that this would ban all private insurance, or if this, you know, a variety of things, you know, the price tag, the taxes, turning over this much power to government, the numbers don't just drop, they plummet.
Mm-hmm.
They plunge.
Look, the lack of faith in government, Charlie,
is
persistent and endemic, and it affects Democrats too. And you know, the whole amorphous nature of a phrase like Medicare for all, you know, occasionally we'll throw a polling question in on a survey, and we'll say, do you favor or oppose the Wilson-Sykes bill in Congress? And there's no such bill. Okay? 75% of people will answer that goddamn question one way or the other. They'll answer the question, even though it is completely made up. And sometimes we'll name it something really absurd, you know, some long exotic title that means nothing. You know, the Etruscan Statuary Protection, whatever. And people will answer the damn question because they think, oh, I guess I should know about that. That sounds okay to me. And that socially desirable response of something that sounds great in a focus group, and when it collides with reality, And when it also lends itself to being turned into something that can be demagogued in a hot minute, even by a slow coach like Donald Trump.
See, and you could do this with issue after issue. You know, again, people are in favor of more restrictions on guns. But when you get to the point of banning certain weapons or gun licensing, I'm sorry, I don't know how they think that's going to play in rural Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, or Wisconsin. I mean, toxic.
I made this point to a group of Democrats the other day, Charlie, and I said, you know, on the gun control matter. And the person I was talking to is a good intentioned person, not an edge case, okay, not a crazy, who was saying, oh, well, you know, the semi-auto ban, we should go after that, and we should go after, you know, mandatory licensing for all currently owned firearms and all. And it was, you know, it wasn't as crazy as, like, seize all the guns, but it was pretty far out there. And I said, where's the election being held in 2020? And he sort of looked at me, and I said, the election is being held in Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Guess what?
Texas.
Florida is the gunshine state.
Mm-hmm.
There are 1.4 million concealed carry permit holders in the state of Florida. Almost all the guns they own are semi-automatic. And guess what? Almost 35% of those people are Democrats.
Okay,
counties.
Let's just stop
right
here.
They don't even understand their own base.
Yeah. So semi-automatic does not mean it's a machine gun. It means you just keep one shot per pull of the trigger. Yeah, it's one of those things that sounds, you know, really sort of attractive.
Of course.
When you dial down. You know, I also noticed this with tax increases and with free stuff as well. The empire of free shit. But everyone loves the idea until they start thinking, wait, I have to pay for other people's free stuff too.
Yeah.
Then the numbers begin to change. Or when people come up with these dramatic increases in taxes, and the Bernie tax thing hasn't really, I think, people haven't really grasped that he's talking about abolishing, you know, wiping out $1.6 trillion in student debt, let's leave that aside, by taxing every single stock and bond transaction, which is your grandma's 401k plan.
Yeah.
Every American there.
In order, by the way, Charlie, in order to pay a $1.something trillion subsidy, mostly to middle class affluent white people.
Hey, I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm getting.
I think so, Bernie may be a closet Republican.
Bernie, you want to talk about? We should have him, you know, be the old man yelling at the clouds. But you know, this thing of wiping out the student debt, it's like, what kind of a bubble do you have to be in to not understand how that plays out in the places where this election will be determined? And the angry emails that I'm getting, they fall into two categories. Number one, people who actually worked and saved and scraped and paid their way through college, or people who took out lots of debt but managed to pay it off themselves,
right.
And people who did not go to college and do not want to have their taxes raised to pay for, as you accurately pointed out, people who have gotten a very, very valuable degree and who are much more likely to have higher incomes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, largely middle class. You know, you go into rural Wisconsin and you sit in front of a group of blue collar and, mm-hmm. you know, and agriculture and people from farms, and you explain to them how, yes, we are going to wipe out $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. And look at their faces and see how that actually plays out. This is why I said we're like the old guys screaming at the clouds. Don't Democrats understand this? Do they want to get rid of Donald Trump, or do they want to engage in this ideological masturbation?
I have said this many times. They are holistically terrible at politics. And the big wins for Democrats in the last 20 years have been because they had two fluky generational candidates who were amazing. On their own, not as a party. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were in the top tier of the top tier of all political candidates in the history of the world. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. They were both gifted in ways that not a single candidate in this field is gifted. Now, that inclination to think that everyone is woke, that woke Twitter is the real America, that the Democratic Party is ready for you know, the rich being carried through the street on tumbrils, you know, it's always one of their inclinations, and they always think this class war thing plays really well. But America's an aspirational country, and a lot of people who aren't wealthy, they have a dream, and their dream is they're going to bust their ass, they're going to work their fingers to the bone, they're going to get up at 5 a.m, they're going to go home at 10 p.m, so that they can be rich, or that their kids can be rich, And the gap with the Democrats is always that they think that the image of the rich in this country is the guy with spats, you know, and a top hat walking down Wall Street. Well, a lot of these folks want to be that. They want to be wealthy. And they don't believe that the only way to get there is the government. And this even matters in the Democratic Party, because as much as we want to think the Democratic Party are all Bernie bros and they're all far left, super progressives, there are a lot of Democrats, again, in those swing electoral states, who are those white working class voters. And you know what? You can turn up African-American participation all the way to the top. You get, let's say you get Barack Obama numbers again with the African-Americans, and you don't close the deal to bring back those white rural Obama Democrats in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, you lose.
You know, it's
still lose.
A couple of points there.
Math is hard.
When you're watching last night, you know, those centrist Democrats were almost invisible. It is as if they do think that Twitter is the beating heart of the Democratic Party, which is not. But also, you mentioned about Barack Obama. I was thinking last night watching this that the Barack Obama who was elected and reelected would be at the right edge of the party right now. When I wrote this piece for Politico, and you saw the reaction to it as well, what I said, you know, 11 ways, there are probably 20 mm-hmm. ways that Democrats can guarantee Trump's re-election. And they're basically warning them against taking extreme steps, as opposed to traditional liberal Democratic positions. Barack Obama now would be perceived as radically unwoke in the new thing, because he's not standing there calling for the kinds of things that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are, or that Julian Castro, and I want to get to him in just a moment.
One of the things about Barack Obama, one of the dirty little secrets of Barack Obama in 2008 and in 2012, was that he scanned as a liberal suburban Republican. He mm-hmm. even said that himself right. one time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that flavor really worked. And we did not have a way to overcome it in 2008 or in 12. And so you saw Republican women voters in the suburbs of Virginia and Pennsylvania, Florida, who ordinarily would be pretty safe bets for the GOP, they weren't voting for someone that they scanned as the dangerous Kenyan Muslim sleeper agent, progressive socialist Bill Ayers, you know, Alinskyite. They were voting for a guy who looked like he would sit at a meeting and go through his 57-page PowerPoint deck to talk about like filling potholes in the community. They liked that affect. He didn't come across in a way, and he didn't speak in a way that contained a lot of the landmines that these guys are putting in front of themselves. All this Trump re-election insurance that we're seeing And it goes back to the big question, Charlie. Democrats truly believe that the only thing standing between them and paradise is a degree of governmental power and to exercise it over whole sectors of the economy, and that's going to fix everything. And you know, as a conservative, and that's still the, you know, as Tom Nichols the other day said, it's still important to remember the three words in Never Trump Conservative. One of them is conservative.
Yeah, I know. They hate that, don't they?
I know. But the analogy I use with my Democratic friend the other day, I'm like, you guys are like fat people. You will do anything to lose weight except diet or exercise.
Oh, geez.
And in this election, you will do anything to win except listen to people who will tell you exactly how we beat you time and time again. And like, well, Obama won. Well, you know what? When Obama won, we took 1,100 seats from them. We took over control of 38 state legislatures and governorships because they didn't understand the tricks we had built and the machine we had built to go after them. And they still won't. And they'll never believe it, Charlie. They will never believe things like gun control kills them in places like Florida.
No, they won't. But now there's two different, you know, I think theories of the case. You and I believe that there are swing voters, persuadable voters, these voters, these suburban Republican women voters who are in play. There's the other school of thought, which is you don't need to appeal to anybody, you know, outside of the blue bubble. You just need to maximize your turnout. This, of course, was the Stacey Abrams, Andrew Gillum model, right?
Right.
That you move left and you just turn out the progressive thing. And Democrats don't seem to have noticed that Stacey Abrams is not the governor of Georgia and Andrew is not the governor of Florida. So, and I think that this is part of this belief that we don't need to talk to you. And so you Never Trumpers shut up because you actually, you know, and look,
one of the things that makes me kind of crazy about it is I was one of the Republican consultants out there who specialized in going into blue states and tricking them to elect conservatives. And I'll say it, I went into blue states and I tricked them.
How do you do that?
Look, we had things, we elected a Republican governor in Vermont four times. We talked about climate change. We talked about education. Now, we were also dismantling, you know, a lot of the things that Howard Dean had done as governor. And we were also, you know, and in other states, you know, we have elected a lot of we punch well above our weight in Florida in terms of the legislature. And it's not because of gerrymandering. It's because we find candidates that fit their districts. And the Democrats should take a lesson away from 18. You know, they think the lesson is AOC. The real lesson is Connor Lamb and Mazie and all these other people who won in red districts and won in conservative districts by not going out there and doing the full, you know, the full Daily Coast parade and going out with every loony idea. And, you know, do you want a Connor Lamb to represent the district there? You kind of do if you're a Democrat.
Well, you know, if you want to control the House of Representatives, you need to run people like Connor Lamb and Abigail Spanberger. But the Democrats immediately pivoted to saying, you know, AOC and Ilhan Omar are the faces of the future. Neither one of them could get elected in those districts under any circumstances.
Yeah. I've said this before, and I really do mean this. You give me 50 Connor Lambs, and I'll win 25 of those guys will take a Republican seat right now because of Trump. You give me 50 AOCs, and I can probably steal one or two. She does not scale in the same way that a Democrat who is not performatively woke can do. Because, look, once you get out of the urban bubble and once you get out of the coastal bubble, there are a lot of Democrats. And it's like Georgia. You know, Stacey Abrams was as hard as she could be on gun control in freaking Georgia. And there are a lot of white rural Democrats outside the donut, the seven counties surrounding Atlanta, who in previous races, you know, that I've done there, we've managed to pull them over on one issue, gun control.
Mm-hmm.
One issue. It is the one issue we discovered years ago. Law enforcement and gun control were sort of hand in glove in their minds, and the Democrats just they can't get it out of their heads. you know, Andrew Gillum was going to get, he was going to roll up Broward, Dade, Palm Beach County, and get in the 60s there no matter what, just by rolling out of bed in the morning. But north of I-4, where the other 40% of the vote lives, there's a lot of white rural Democrats. And there are a lot of non-party affiliateds who are functionally Democrats on economic matters, but functionally Republicans on social.
Well, right. And he also, in a state with zero income tax, where people, millions of people have moved there because of that, was saying, elect me and I will raise the income tax. I will create an income tax.
As a Florida resident, I can tell you that the idea of raising an income tax in Florida is second in the list of bad ideas to like serving mandatory baby meat at schools. The voters are repulsed by it. They retired there so they wouldn't pay the New York and Pennsylvania income taxes anymore, and New Jersey income taxes. That's why people move there.
Exactly. And the abortion issue plays out this way as well, I think. That there are, see, here's in what I have in my mind is that, look, you and I are never going to vote for Donald Trump. There's just no way.
No.
But realistically, a lot of people who are not us, who share our views of Donald Trump, might not behave in the same way under these circumstances. So, for example, if you are really appalled by Donald Trump, but you are pro-life, might be willing to vote for somebody who's sort of generically pro-life. Generically pro-choice. Even somebody who's going to, name a liberal Supreme Court justice. You might live with that. But what the Democrats now are doing is they are upping the ante. No limits whatsoever when you can have an abortion, late term, right up until birth. Taxpayer funding for abortions. This makes it that much harder for socially conservative or socially moderate voters. The same thing is you could be this suburban Republican woman who says, everything about Donald Trump is absolutely repulsive, but I don't want to see Democrats come in and take over the healthcare system, take away my private health insurance, and tank the economy with their massive, free stuff and tax increases. I could really, the nightmare scenarios, those people go, I hate Trump. I hate the idea of four more years of Trump, but I just can't vote for this hellscape that I might be, ushering in if I vote for a Democrat.
And I'm going to make our Democratic friends really angry now.
Oh, we've already
America,
done that.
Yeah. I know. America had a truce on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
America's truce on abortion, and we saw this. And look, I've looked at the polling on pro-life and pro-choice for 30 years. And I've done races in 38 states all across this country. And the basic broad stroke 30,000 foot view is Americans want to preserve Roe versus Wade and keep abortion legal. However, they are incredibly uncomfortable with abortion once you probe in just a tiny fraction of that. They don't want abortions after, again, 30,000 foot view. They don't want abortions after the first trimester as a rule. They definitely don't want abortions after fetal viability. That's like in the 90s. They are super, super worried about abortions in the third trimester, even with the predicates of saying life of the mother, that still doesn't even scrape a majority. So that truce that basically, both sides lived with for about 25 years of this battle was that abortion would be legal, that we would not pour federal funding into it in any massive degree that made it more popular or whatever. Essentially you have a one provider system with Planned Parenthood, which never polls very well in the 30,000 foot view. They sometimes get a plurality approval, but mostly not. And these aren't my ideological preferences talking. This isn't what I believe is whether abortion is good or bad or whether it should be legal or illegal. The reality of it is that truce is going to be broken. Now, it's being broken on both sides.
Right, it is.
And if I were the Democrats, I would look at this year, take a deep breath, and instead of saying, we want government-funded, government-subsidized free abortions for everybody at the drive-through, and yay, abortion is fun and it tickles, they should be saying, We believe Roe versus Wade is important in this country. We recognize that abortion is a difficult decision for any woman. And what we are terrified of is that white male legislators in these states are depriving women of even the remotest chance of a choice to have an abortion if, in the cases of rape, incest, or the life of the mother. It would be it's the easiest political lift ever.
Okay, I'm glad to hear you say that, because this is the 2-inch putt. This is a 1-inch putt. Yeah. To be able to, and the numbers are overwhelming. Focus on rape victims. Focus on the Roe versus Wade. You're talking about 70%, and instead, and again, there's no question about it that in terms of the truce that's being broken, what's happening in Georgia and Alabama break the truce, and a lot of pro-lifers even divided the pro-life movement that those positions were in fact too extreme. Okay, why don't you get you to comment on this, and we're going to just so Rick, I'm going to play this for you off my phone, and we will Jim Swift will actually drop it in. But speaking of abortion, how far, just the way they talk about it, some people are saying that Julian Castro had a great night last night. I disagree on that, but let's make sense of this. Hold on.
Would your plan cover abortion, Mr. Secretary?
Yes, it would. I don't believe only in reproductive freedom. I believe in reproductive justice. And, what that means is that just because a woman, or let's also not forget someone in the trans community, a trans female, is poor doesn't mean they shouldn't have the right to exercise that right to choose. And so I absolutely would cover the right to have an abortion. More than that, everybody in this crowd and watching at home knows that in our country today, a person's right to choose is under assault in places like Missouri, in Alabama, in Georgia. I would appoint judges to the federal bench that understand the precedent of Roe v. Wade and will respect it.
Okay, I mean that's boilerplate. But okay, what's it? Throwing in the trans thing, it's like, yes, I'm not only in favor of abortion without any limitations. I'm not only in favor of abortion with a limitation paid for by the taxpayers, but I got to throw in my reference to the trans community.
Apparently, he's discovered some sort of the miracle of the magically appearing ovaries, because that's what would happen if you had a pregnant trans person. Look, no hate on trans people. Okay. They do what they do. I've got a broad libertarian thing. Go do your thing, yep. Right? Go have fun. Enjoy your life. Be what you want to be. But, there's the party of science for you right there. And I'm sorry. It is also one of these things where he is indulging the super far fringe edge of the tiniest fraction of the Democratic base. And saying some stupid shit that a guy like me already, I promise you, and I probably even know who's doing it. There's a guy like me somewhere right now. He's in a studio. He's cutting together a funny, horrible ad about Julian Castro and the Democratic Party want to pay for abortions for transsexuals. And I guarantee you that ad is not something we'll ever see on television. It'll go out. It'll circulate virally. It'll be on people's YouTube feeds. It'll be from some bullshit group. But it'll go out among soft and leaning Christian Democrats in the swing states, and it'll be viral and kind of darkly horrible and funny and all that other stuff. And it's just
and your grandpa and your uncle will have seen this by next
year. And they'll share it on 5 million Facebook feeds, on True Real Republican Trump MAGA News 9000
Rising Patriot.
That is
a problem. Now, speaking of Castro, he really went after Beto O'Rourke. And by the way, I thought Beto was just awful last night. And I say this as somebody that really thought that, had he won that Senate seat, he would have been, maybe the front runner for the nomination. And I predicted he would be one of the top three candidates. I agree with Jonathan Last in the Bulwark today. He's toast. He was awful. But there was that real moment where Castro was trying to, cut him off at the knees by demanding, Castro's position is he's in favor of decriminalizing illegal border crossings, and he's pounding on O'Rourke for not being in favor of all of that. I think that immigration is not a winner for Donald Trump. I think it's a potential big winner for the Democrats. but not if they walk into the, yes, we actually are for open borders.
Right.
So is that unfair?
And again, it's one of the truces we used to have in our society. We used to understand that there were going to be people who crossed the border illegally to come to the U.S. to work. And this was something that both sides sort of grunted and shrugged about. We kind of knew it as a society. And, you know, it was a problem that needed some sort of tweaking here and there, but it wasn't. It didn't call for, on the one hand, building the giant wall with the laser alligator moat, or on the other hand, swing wide the gates and let everyone flow in without restriction or accountability. And you know, the idea that we're going to have a country that is welcoming to immigrants, I think, is fundamental to the American character.
Yes, very much so.
And I think it is vital. And I also think, once again, here's where the Democrats had a great narrative, okay? And the point they missed last night, Charlie, is that this referendum is not about any of their bullshit. It's not about any of their policies. No one gives a fuck about their policies or anyone's policies. This is a referendum on Donald fucking Trump. If they don't get that, they're going to go through these things. They're going to build up a giant film library, and the nominee is going to have to suck it up and embrace several of these lunatic policies that are surefire issue losers, and they're going to be stuck with the artifacts of their indiscipline, weighing in on them. And again, like I said, they'll do anything to win except listen to people who understand how we beat them.
Well, this was the question I was going to ask you next, but I think you've already addressed it. You know, I was amazed at how little attention they paid to Donald Trump. I mean, obviously there was the obligatory shout out, but really this would debate. They've almost like decided that we're not going to run against Trump. We're going to throw out all of these bizarre policy issues, and as a result of that, you can just imagine the Trump people sitting back and going, "This is so sweet."
If I was in the Trump campaign headquarters last night, I would have been having a double and laughing my ass off. And I know the Democrats get so mad at this. Wow, you can't lecture us about our party because you're an evil Republican.
Right.
I'm like the spy who came in from the cold, and I've got a big fucking briefcase full of all the data of all the things I've done to you over the years. And here's one that they should understand. Discipline matters for them. If you're going up against an incumbent, even a crazy incumbent like Donald Trump, even a 42%er like Donald Trump, they have significant powers to communicate and to frame the message. You need to be disciplined and rigidly on it all the time. Barack Obama was an unbelievably disciplined candidate, whereas John McCain was all over the board. Bill Clinton was undisciplined personally and incredibly disciplined politically because he knew he had to go right up the middle in 1992, and he did.
Now, again, I want to clarify something, because every time you and I make this point, or I'll speak for myself, I get accused of basically saying, well, what you're trying to say is you want the Democrats just to be more like Republicans. And
that is exactly wrong, right?
Oh,
my God, you're exactly right. I get that all the time. Mm-hmm. And I always say, did I tell you to not be pro-choice?
Yeah.
Did I tell you to not be for gun control? Did I tell you to not be? Politics is not a game where you show all your fucking cards.
Yeah.
Politics is a game where you make a presentation to people who are not like you and who are not you and who don't necessarily share the views of the Burlington Community Center Socialist fucking Glee Club. And so, you know, you got to campaign in the big country. And not just in green rooms, and not just in woke Twitter.
Yeah, you can be a progressive Democrat without being crazy, without proposing things that just set yourself on fire.
Right.
You know,
the equation isn't is your policy good or not?
Yeah. So
the equation is your policy sell or not?
Yeah. Light a candle in the darkness does not mean pouring kerosene all over yourself and lighting yourself off in the middle of the town square. Okay, there's a distinction here, people. We're all in favor of you lighting a candle in the darkness. I mean, wow. Where do you come down on Trump impeachment? I'm also struck, and I've said this before, about how inept the Democrats have been on all of this. I understand the political arguments about impeachment, and maybe you agree with them. I don't know. But it's just their failure to engage on all of this has normalized Donald Trump.
Yep.
And we've created this asymmetry of outrage where Donald Trump continues to be as erratic, as behaving as bizarrely and as corruptly as he ever does. And yet it's sort of like we shrug it off because that's Trump. He's been so awful that he's normalized his awfulness. So we focus on, you know, the purity test for the Democrats. And the Democrats have fallen into this. And the analogy, I mean, the point that I've made over and over and over again is just think about what happened with Biden last week. And I'm not necessarily defending Biden, but you had Donald Trump come out and refuse to apologize to the Central Park Five. I've become a broken record about this. He had called for their death penalty. And there's clearly huge racial overtones to all of this. He refuses to apologize. He doubles down on it. And that was in the news cycle for about 5 minutes because we spent the next week beating up on Joe Biden for saying that getting things done and being civil means working with some long-dead segregationist senators that nobody had ever heard of before all of this. And they pounded and pounded and pounded away at all of that. And it's like, is this the way it's going to be, where Donald Trump can do anything? He knows that his base will cover him. He knows that his turd polishers will defend him. And anytime a Democrat uses the wrong pronoun, we're going to go into multiple news cycles beating the crap out of him?
This is top level. You know, the sad part of this equation in terms of holding Donald Trump accountable is that since we don't have an independent Justice Department any longer, the only people that can hold him accountable are Democrats in Congress.
Yes.
And Nancy Pelosi has ferociously got her foot on the brake to try to keep this from becoming an impeachment hearing. I have said this from the very, very beginning. I mean, I'm talking about from January of 2017, when Democrats go, why won't we impeach him? Tell me where you get to the votes in the Senate.
Yeah.
Just tell me, show me one scenario of something Donald Trump could be caught and impeached on.
Nothing.
Where you would get the requisite number of Republican votes to move over in the Senate. There is nothing, including murder. I guarantee you at this point, Lindsey Graham will go, well, you know what? I think they probably deserved it, because they will defend anything.
Well, at least he fights, right?
Does.
Yeah.
At least he fights.
He fights. So he killed those people, but he fights. That's what I like about him.
Yeah. And so there is no chance you're going to get a conviction.
Yeah.
And a lot of Democrats, in the way that we've seen over and over again, is they believe that. And by the way, there's a little polling on this too, which makes my eyes pop out. They believe if he's impeached in the House, that he has to he's removed from office.
Yeah.
Just Democrats, just so, if you're listening.
Yeah. No.
Read it. He has to be convicted in the Senate for there to be a sanction. And if he gets impeached in the House, Mitch McConnell laughs his ass off and goes, "Yeah, fuck you," and doesn't even take it up for trial in the Senate.
So what should they do?
What they should do is they should. It just says Mitch McConnell waives the rules. They should waive the rules and the 1 week notices and all these fucking hearings. Sorry, I'm salty today. They should waive the notices and all these hearings
today. Hold it, wait, today. You're saying today? Because Rick is not normally like this.
You're right.
I didn't see this coming.
Sailors blush when they see me coming. They're so afraid of my life.
When we started this podcast saying that we're going to be two old guys, you know, angry old guys yelling at the clouds, nobody could possibly have guessed that Rick Wilson might be a little salty. Okay, so
yeah, I know,
so,
right?
My apologies.
The Democrats right now are working in this very methodical way, but they're doing the 7-day notifications on the hearings, and they're playing by all these rules. They're letting these Trump scumbags testify behind closed doors over and over again. They need to make this a public spectacle. They need to have Bill Barr in that goddamn seat over and over again, or if he doesn't show, start dragging his people in there. They need to exercise their prerogatives. They need to start holding people in contempt. They need to start pushing harder. They should have had Hope Hicks crying in that goddamn chamber. They should have been raking her over the coals over and over again. They should have been going at these people publicly, all of them. You know, Don McGahn, Hope Hicks, but Bill Barr, all these people need to be in the light. And the fact that the Republicans will, and one of their reasons for doing it in private is like, well, the Republicans cause a shenanigan every time. Let them. This, you can't build a public momentum to get you to the point where the political climate changes to allow impeachment to be possible until you start doing this in public.
Okay,
it is also the only thing that counteracts Trump himself. It is the only newsworthy thing where he can't tweet his way out of it.
Okay, maybe this is a sign of my naivete. This is what I thought the Democrats were going to do. This is exactly what I thought was going to happen, that they would have those hearings, they would begin to educate the public, they would begin to see if they could move the needle on public public opinion. And here we are sitting almost in July, and none of that's happened.
Right, and if they don't start...
I'm amazed, yeah.
Look, Nancy Pelosi needs to blow the loud whistle and say, fuck it, recess. Nope, we're not doing it. We're back in session. We are going to be here. We're going to do this in the long, hot summer. We're going to grind it and grind it. And the Democrats need to stop falling for the infrastructure weak bait. Okay? They will never, ever, ever get a deal with Donald Trump on anything. He does this to pull them down. They're like Lucy with the freaking football.
Okay, they know that now, don't they? Please, come on, Rick.
You know who doesn't know it? You know who doesn't know it? I've heard this from people around him. Chuck Schumer does not know it.
No.
I mean, if there's an anti-Mitch McConnell, it's Chuck Schumer. And I don't mean that ideologically. I mean that in terms of pure incompetence as a party leader. I mean, he should be doing what McConnell did to Harry Reid. Sand, friction, noise, pain all the time. And you know what? Harry Reid still had all the advantages and all the power, but Mitch McConnell made his life hell all the time. He caused nothing but agony for the guy. And, you know, the idiots like Ted Cruz who would pop up and go, I'd rather have 30 Republicans than the majority.
What the heck?
Remember that? When he was trying to do the shutdown? He's like, I'd rather have 30 serious Republicans than a majority. Well, you know what 30 serious Republicans gets you? Well, if you got $4 in your pocket, you also get a venti latte at Starbucks. And that's it. You know, nothing. So, you know, the Senate Democrats are not really worth, you know, their salt right now. And so the House guys need to accelerate and turn this process into a public spectacle. We're not on this isn't a campaign or a government anymore. This is a reality show. You're running this entire operation of resistance and accountability against the master of the form of reality shows. And unless you publicly start causing his friends and the people he cares about to be pained, humiliated, interrogated, investigated, etc., you're going to end up with the guy having complete, you know, control of the agenda.
Okay, so let's leave this on a positive note. I don't know whether we will or not. Is there anything that the Democrats can do tonight in the debate to change the dynamic that you and I have been ranting and railing about?
Well, I mean, look, tonight is a test of Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And that test of Joe Biden is when Bernie and the rest of them do the pile on, does Joe Biden come out of this looking like a front runner or like an old man yelling at clouds?
Yeah. No, see, he needs to be not doddery, not right. Vague, and not hyper defensive. That's
yeah. And he needs to say the words Obama about 750 times.
Yeah, I think he probably knows that. What is he going to say, though, about the issue of, because they're going to come back. Everybody understands now that this issue of abolishing private health insurance is front and center. Is he going to be able to stand up against the progressive left? Does he have to do that to say? And then what's the blowback if he says, no, you know, I want everybody to have health insurance, but I do not want people. And by the way, I thought John Delaney actually had the most intelligent comments on all of this. He's not going to be at the end. But it's like, you know, here's your state of your Democratic Party. When John Delaney is trying to educate you about the consequences of your most important policy recommendation. And of course, they completely ignored him.
And in fact, the MSNBC guy shut him down a couple of times.
I know. Which,
you know, as much as I think John Delaney is, you know, a footnote, it was an interesting note to me because it was clearly more desirable in terms of the producers. And look, if you're a producer, what do you want to see? You want to see the fight. You want to see, you know, Beto O'Rourke getting his head handed to him by the most hated man in America, Bill de Blasio.
God, loathsome guy, yeah.
He's just, you know, Bill de Blasio and Rob George wrote a really good piece this morning in the Post about this. De Blasio understands the Democratic base and he's sort of an exemplar of this entire problem we've been talking about the whole show, Charlie, is he won't focus on the referendum on Trump, he's going to try to out-left everybody else.
Well, sure. He's the Democratic nominee, you know, and I can guarantee you he'll win at least some boroughs of New York.
Boroughs, yeah, exactly.
But he's going to lose, you know, the other 49 states.
If you want a Donald Trump sweep, there you go. But to loop back on Biden for 1 second, because I know we're running out of time. The other thing Joe Biden needs to say when he's confronted on this is to say, look, I was on the front lines with Barack Obama when we passed the most meaningful health care reform in this country's history. We worked tirelessly, and it wasn't perfect. But I can tell you what I will do. I'll work with Democrats. I'll work with Republicans of good faith. I will get this job done. It's too important. I've lost too many people I love to think that America's healthcare system isn't good enough. You know, and I think he has a real chance if he does that. And the other thing that he has to do to wrap it up, as he should wrap up every answer, is, you know, the Carthage must be destroyed. And the question isn't whether we're going to do my version of healthcare reform or Bernie's version of healthcare reform. The question is whether which of us can stand on a stage and go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump, kick his ass, defeat him, drive him from Washington, and bring back this country.
I think that's an effective argument. I actually do think—
Some people think I'm pretty good at this shit.
No, you actually are pretty good at this shit. And in fact, I'm hoping that the Biden folks give you a call this afternoon. But, you know, I also want a unicorn for Christmas. But
well, yeah.
Rick Wilson, thank you. Thank you.
As always, my friend.
Thank you so much for this Not Safe for Work podcast. I appreciate it.
Enjoy Aspen.
I fully intend to. In fact, I'm going to be on a panel on the future of conservatism, which will be— it will be lit. Maybe not today, but tomorrow. I will let people know afterwards.
I think the answer is blasted radioactive Mad Max hellscape.
I don't want to raise expectations, but yes. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes from Aspen. We will be doing this. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.